United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All of business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
To my right is Judge Peach, and to my left is Judge Lienberg. We're here today in the matter of Wozinski against Wilkie, number 18-0678. This case concerns whether the Department of Veterans Affairs should provide attorneys who represent claimants during regional office proceedings with access to draft-ready decisions, just as veteran service organizations have access. Several issues associated with this case, including whether Mr. Wozinski has standing to raise this issue, whether the court can reach the merits of Mr. Wozinski's dispute, and if so, whether the department must provide attorneys with access to a draft rating decision in the same manner as it provides access to veteran service organizations. Would counsel for both parties please state your note your appearance for the record.
Douglas Wozinski, pro se.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sarah Ficina on behalf of the Secretary, and with me at counsel's table is Mark Vichich.
Good morning. Vichich. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, in fact, the appellant. Would you wish to reserve a portion of your time for a vote?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll reserve 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Thank you. Mr. Wozinski, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. It appears that today is going to be all about tradition. I congratulate the court on its very new decision in Monk overturning its traditional view of class actions and look forward to participating in those Rule 23 guided cases. It's also about tradition in that I am here both pro se, or as I tend to view it, in the untraditional role of representing not one veteran or one client, but all of my clients.
Sadly, the Secretary still has not had such a revelation here. Since we last met in the previous petition hearing, I am aware of no action by the Secretary.
Well, why didn't you appeal that?
Because I thought it would be more timely to refile a petition addressing the issues that the court...
Well, now the court has to deal with it again. Do you consider that, with all respect, an efficient use of this court's time? You could have appealed it. You raised the same issues. In fact, you quote from my dissent.
Yes, sir.
Why don't you appeal it? Get it over with. Let the Federal Circuit decide it. It's important.
Because I thought...
By the way, I practiced law for 45 years. I didn't like it when I got a question like that from the judge. So, in all fairness, you don't have to answer if it's a matter of lawyer judgment. I respect that. If you made a judgment call that it would be better to refile and bring it here, fair enough.
Yes, Your Honor. That I do not take offense from the question. It's a fair question. I did it intentionally to get back to this court, to allow this court to decide an issue before this court with additional information and the law that I am prepared to discuss in detail this morning. If there was an error in the previous petition, it was my fault in not raising, perhaps, this law, which I did not believe was necessary or relevant to the issues that we brought at that point. I focused explicitly on the first petition on the economic basis for standing, and the court disagreed. I am here on statutory basis for standing, which I believe is important for the court to hear as well.
Mr. Rosensky, did you say that, to your knowledge, nothing has been done by the Secretary with respect to this issue?
I have received no information that any changes have been made, and I checked the website M21MR section 2 days ago, 3 days ago, and there was no changes noted there.
And if I recall, the decision that we issued last was January 2018?
That sounds correct, Your Honor, yes. It's been several months, many months.
I'm interested, Mr. Rosensky, in your personal stake in this case in terms of the economic impact, the injury. If you recall from the last time you were here, you received a lot of questions in that area, and I'd like to see if we can pin that down. Injury, in fact, economic or otherwise?
Yes, Your Honor. It is not part of the standing that I was prepared to talk about, but it is. I do believe that economic standing, the issues we raised in the previous petition, are reasonably reasonable injury. In fact, it is difficult to establish exact dollar figure for any particular delay. However, several points there I believe were misunderstood or misrepresented. Anytime there's a delay in a veteran's case, especially a delay that requires an appeal of any sort to any level, even within the RO. DRO decisions are now taking years to schedule. Okay. On top of that, you have the very well-ventilated delays to certify to the board decisions, et cetera. Those are years and years and years, sometimes 7 to 8 years, for a simple omission, a simple failure to address a relevant law or overlooking a medical exam that was in a file. Attorneys do not always and should not ever consider the fees or make more on the fee. There was a comment in the decision about sometimes attorneys make a greater fee on the delay. Perhaps. There are many cases, such as when there's an earlier effective date issue, where the fee isn't going to change on a contingency because that is a fixed amount of money. There are a lot of those issues. Further, a slight increase in the fee is not going to overcome the amount of effort that, and looking out for the veteran's best interest is the key here. I have yet to see a petition to this court where the attorney was asking the court to slow down the VA. Every petition is for speed, is to benefit the veteran, and I am a little irritated.
Well, wait a minute, if I may. Sorry,
no,
Judge Davis, did you?
No, I'm good.
Are you abandoning the economic impact on the lawyer part of this?
No, Your Honor, I'm not abandoning it.
My view, as you remember from my dissent, was it didn't matter. You didn't have to establish economic harm, in fact, in order to have standing. But that's that's not the way the court ruled. So
I am not abandoning it. As you know, we did not have a full briefing on this. I am not abandoning it. I just believe I'm trying to argue that I believe it is legitimate. I do not bring you new dollar numbers for it, but I am not abandoning it. I think it is before the court and could be reconsidered, all right, under the rest of the argument that I am prepared to make.
Well, what is your standing argument, then?
I believe that both as an attorney and the client involved here have standing as an invasion of a statutory right. And denial.
What statute?
5701 and 5904.
What is that? What do they say?
That
benefits
taken together, you have a right to review the information that the VA has on you, and that attorneys have a right to stand for their clients in doing that. That is the basis. Also, there is just FOIA, where we can get the information. There are rights. The quote that I will give you here is from Worth v. Selden. The actual threatened injury required by Article III may exist solely by virtue of statutes creating legal rights, the invasion of which creates standing. 422 U.S. 490. And I apologize, there's many cases here that were not briefed to the court. And I
Worth v. Selden is a 1980, Section 1983 case, isn't it? Civil Rights Act of 1871.
But the court addressed the issue of standing generally and as provided as statutory violations provide standing in certain circumstances. All right? And that circumstance obviously didn't apply here. But I am arguing, and I believe fully, that when the Secretary violates a statutory right, there is standing, regardless of economics or anything else. Also,
Mr. Rosinski, what you're saying now is that the veteran has a right to some information, and that's what gives him standing?
Yes.
And that information is what?
Specifically, anything that is in or a part of his claims file.
And so what we're talking about in this case is a draft decision from the regional office.
Well, Your Honor, there's a secondary point, and I will answer your question. We have used the word draft, or I have used the word draft, and pre-promulgation interchangeably. I believe that if you look at the Sellers case, which came up in the previous petition, the Sellers case makes that an incorrect use of terms. We are talking about a completed rating decision.
But
that has not been promulgated by notice. The notice is what turns that into a binding decision. So to be clear, when I was referring to drafts, or we refer to drafts today, talking about rating decisions that are complete but not promulgated. And when they're not promulgated, the Sellers case made clear, they are not binding. In Sellers, which was raised as a potential impediment to attorneys looking at what we were calling draft rating decisions, because then they would be promulgated. The court explicitly found there was a completed rating decision and there was a completed promulgation notice. All right, and in a footnote 14 in that case, that is what they stated. That is, and per regulation, that is when a decision is binding on VA, is when it is promulgated by notice. So what we're really talking about here are completed rating decisions that are presented to people to review, make comment on. Those things can be redone right there because the person who signed it is the only person who has given some kind of authority.
And you want to be put in the – oh, sorry, Judge.
May I just continue? Sure. But the manual refers to it as a draft decision.
I understand that.
And now what you're saying, though, Mr. Rosinski, is that could your client – on his or her own, get that document?
No. Right now, no. And I'm not advocating that every client...
Then how is it his... If he can't get it...
It's not promulgated. He could get it. If the Secretary said, here is a table full of all today's completed rating decisions, please review them, as some courts do with orders. You know, you pass an order back and forth and the parties agree to it. Obviously the judge has a final say, but they draft language. This is not necessarily unusual. I understand if you let all people in all the time, that could be a problem. But you're letting thousands of VSOs, theoretically, in to do this. That's why it's not promulgated. That's why they can do it, per the regulations and the law. If it had a notice on it, it was formal. Even if they found an error, they'd have to go through a formal process of revision or appeal.
But if the client can't get it, how can you argue that he has a right to it and that's the injury?
The client does have a right to that information, particularly if they're giving it to others. In this situation, if the Secretary wants to say no one can see these final draft decisions, all right?
But even under records management, it's not final. It's not in the record.
If it's completed. That's why it's a significant difference. In the Sellers case, that was found in the record. That's the point. That's why they said it was Both of those documents were in the record, were in the claims file record. So the difference here is if they can't show it to the, if they can show it to VSOs, why can't they show it to attorneys? It's the same. If they can show it to anybody, right, it should be the veterans representative, and the veterans representatives, the issue is why only some veterans representatives can see it. They're seeing it. Their clients are seeing it through them. The issue here is the right to all representatives to see it. Perhaps this will clarify. In Public Citizen versus DOJ, 491 U.S. 440, right, as when an agency denies requests for information under FOIA, refusal to permit a party to scrutinize agency activities to the extent the law allows constitutes a sufficiently distant injury to provide standing, distinct injury to provide standing to sue. And that's a close paraphrase. All right. This is the same type of case. We're asking to see the same information that the government has said can be seen.
Isn't this a scheme put together by the secretary? I think by regulation, right? VSOs are allowed to see these draft opinions. As I understand it, there's physically a table at the regional office, and the VSOs have a seat at the table, physically.
That is my understanding.
That's it. So why don't you keep it simple? What you're asking for is a declaration that you, a lawyer representing a particular client, have the same access to the draft report or the draft finding, whatever it's called, as a VSO representing the veteran has. Isn't that all you want?
Yes, Your Honor. I've tried to now, say that.
All right. So that's what you want. Now, I have another question. Since you're here not as a class representative, are you?
No,
you're not. Right? You've changed your mind on that. Well, what happens to all the other lawyers? How are they going to find out about this?
Your Honor, and I mean this sincerely, not to be glib, that's kind of their problem. This case is...
Well, that's
around.
Not... That doesn't sound to me...
No,
right.
That is exactly what...
That's why... Just a minute. That's why I thought you were right on your class action application, but if you are just here on your own saying Wyszynski gets to see this stuff, but too bad for the other lawyers who haven't thought the way I thought, that don't seem right to me.
That is not what I meant to say, Your Honor.
Would you object if the court were to find, and I'm certainly not suggesting that the court is going to do that, find that you have standing? What if we were to order the secretary to publish this opinion, if the court were to so find, and send it to every veteran, VA.gov, or whatever they do?
I would welcome that. I have no objection.
Whether it's a class action or not.
No, absolutely.
Don't you think it's right that all lawyers be apprised of this in the most efficient way?
Absolutely. And that is initially why I filed this as a class action when I had representation. Representation for a class action was sought, and the parties who I thought were available and I would trust to handle such a matter declined. I bring it, and then the thought occurred to me to bring this as an individual to illustrate exactly the point, Your Honor, that this case can only apply to me because it's not a class action, and perhaps Monk came out of the skies today to highlight the difference, because that was always the question posed to me in the court's order of how I was going to represent myself in a class action. I withdrew the issues so I could appear before you on my claim, as every veteran has to do. I didn't mean it that the other lawyers could not hear about it. I want all the lawyers to hear about it. This is not a class action because, frankly, the other reason I repetitioned and withdrew the class action is I did not know when Monk was going to come out, and I didn't want to delay a decision in this case pending Monk.
You must be reading Monk differently than I am.
I've only glanced at it.
Well, you better glance again. Class action was denied.
In that case.
Yes.
But I read...
So it's not a here, great, come and get it, Dave.
Well, I read that rule... that.
And I dissented.
I know, Your Honor, but unfortunately, very unfortunately for me in this case, sometimes that is not...
All right, in all seriousness, what's wrong? I'm going to ask the Secretary the same thing. What's wrong with this court ordering, whatever the decision is, you don't have standing, or you do have standing, that it be published for all the world to see, not just those who happen to get this?
I encourage that completely. I believe that all of the cases that affect anybody other than that individual should be that way. I'm a very big advocate of the class action, and as I had several pending and been dismissed for various reasons until Monk came out. I participated a bit in Monk. The point here is that third-party standing was the question that was missing in the first case. Third-party standing requires two things: a close relationship between the third-party representative and the person or person's representative. The Supreme Court has a multitude of cases that have declared attorney-client to be one of the close associations. All right, the second thing is that there's some impediment or barrier to the individual first party bringing the case. I submit that now two petitions, still no answer to eight responses, and 4.5 years of effort by an experienced counsel, whether it demonstrated that in this case or not, shows, and still no action from the Secretary, shows there is an impediment to an average veteran client coming to this court and seeking relief in this issue. So third-party standing, and again, I have a multitude of citations which I will happily provide to the court or to the clerks that support that. It's been used for decades by the Supreme Court. All of these are Supreme Court decisions.
Mr. Rosinski, I'm assuming that you have clients who are at various stages in the process of claims.
Yes, ma'am.
And including perhaps the process that is at the RO stage and at the stage where a draft decision has is what you want to get to look at.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't know, why did you not take one of those clients on behalf of that client Peach, and say, I want client Peach's draft.
Well, before you answer that question, could you have 10 minutes, please? Go ahead.
Well, one, I didn't really want to burden all these clients with additional litigation.
All it takes
is
one.
Secondly, well, this, Your Honor, if I may, this case is based on Mr. Grawl's case. The letters are all based on his case. And I can provide the case numbers, but it is actually was a decision, and I said, why can't I get access to these decisions? Several other decisions came out over the years for Mr. Grawl himself. That is the basis.
So you've asked on behalf of Mr. Grawl that draft decision?
Yeah, the record in the previous petitions, yes. They're all regarding Mr. Grawl's case specifically. And then generically, why can't I see decisions? You know, and
they turned you down on Mr. Grawl's case?
Well, they didn't turn me down for 4 years. They just didn't say anything. You know, and Mr. Grawl's case has been resolved. And quite frankly, I didn't want to get him involved in this. There's health issues involved. But the point is that I do believe strongly that it's important that attorneys can also defend themselves and have issues resolved here that affect the provision of their services to veterans. And that is a very important case, and that is why I have not abandoned the economic theory, Judge Greenberg. I believe all of these theories apply. There's others as well. You know, the key principle here is, and this is a holding of a case, when a third party is involved and their rights are somehow truncated or prejudiced by the treatment of another, that is where third party standing is most appropriate. And that's what we have here. They have blocked me from access. It doesn't affect me day to day. It affects my ability to help these veterans. But they're definitely impacted because they're the ones who are going to have to wait years and years and years to get something resolved. The fee issue is a red herring here, okay? If you really believe that there are any number of attorneys who are doing these things to get fees, I disagree strongly. And that's my irritation with this case, Judge Greenberg, is that they said we don't cooperate. we don't help them try to settle cases. They said some pretty serious reasons, okay, that stem back to the 1860s when these things did happen. Attorneys do not do these things, at least none that I know, and certainly not myself, to generate fees. We're trying not to. We cooperating, as there's a plaque I saw at some fish store. If I agreed with you, we'd both be wrong, okay? Our job is not to agree, to cooperate as much as possible, but to put the veteran first, not to worry about disrupting a system that is going in the wrong direction. And that's the root of this. Why do they not want us involved?
Mr. Rosinski, I'd like to tie up a couple of loose ends on your statutory standing argument. You cited, I believe, 5701 and 5904. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Could you direct us precisely to the language you're referring to in both of those statutes? And I want you to complete your argument because you haven't gotten there yet.
I will. Let me reserve that, and I will do that on rebuttal. I will point that out because there are some other points I would like to.
Yeah, but you're going to answer the chief.
I will answer the chief. I do not have it with me right now. Okay. I have it in my notes somewhere, and I will answer that question. But specifically on 5904, as a representative charged with assisting and litigating these cases for a veteran, it is inherent in that we represent the veteran and have all the authority and rights that the veteran has to see his own information. We can't litigate under the model rules.
So the policy interferes with your representation.
It interferes with our representation, yes, Your Honor. And 5701 generally says that the secretary may allow access to information. The secretary's allowed access to information in an improper manner here. That if you're going to allow, they're not allowing me information or an attorney access to information solely because we're attorneys. And that the veteran who chooses an attorney, it's not as Cushman would say, a fundamentally fair process. So to quickly complete, that is not the only standing argument here. This issue. There are several others.
Well, so far I have direct standing, I have statutory standing, and I have third-party standing.
And then in Adiran, the injury is a discriminatory classification. Right? That is the injury, specifically stated. No equal footing, no level playing field. And that, again, goes back to 5904. I can't do my job under the model rules when the playing field's not level between the parties. Also, the veteran has a right to fundamental fairness under Cushman. This is his right, all right? As the I am here on the third-party representative to defend his right to fundamental fairness. That is the underlying standing here. This is fundamentally unfair to attorney-represented veterans. All the rest of them are additions. A fundamental fairness issue. It's a violation of the constitutional right, term right was used by the Cushman Court, to fundamental fairness. When a choice of representative, I believe this is a fundamental issue, when a choice of representative, both certified and allowed by the secretary, determines whether you have a 5-year extra appeal period or not, that's fundamentally unfair. That's the bottom line of all of this law. And that is the one I stake the highest fundamental truth in.
That it's depriving you access creates delay for your clients?
Depriving me access creates delay, possibility of delay, as well as it's fundamentally unfair for one group of veterans to know what issues there are and why they're in there, or to be able to correct errors, and the other side can't.
Well, can't in that process, but there is a process you can, right? Correct errors.
Yes, you can appeal. You can appeal anything and everything, but to avoid an appeal, I submit, whether I have the dollars or not, is an incredibly significant economic as well as lifestyle impacting process for a veteran. Forget the attorney. For the veteran. I'm talking strictly to veteran here. The veteran has a right to fundamental fairness. I'm representing those, the people whose fundamental right to fundamental fairness has been and continues to be impacted by this policy, which is based on tradition.
But the client could have a choice. He could choose you or he could choose the VSO.
That's right. And first of all, he doesn't know, he or she doesn't know, and most attorneys don't know, that there is this significance in choosing between. Remember, VSOs are free. A lot of people go there, all right? If you're going to do this, and I submit that perhaps they need to know that by getting an attorney, you're not going to get this right. You may have to. That is certainly something that would impact the reasonable person's choice. Well, I can go to an attorney, and he can win the case, but I'm going to have to wait 5 more years. Let me take a chance with this guy. Right? I don't know how to explain it. Words are escaping me.
We understand. Sorry, Judge. Yeah, but that's exactly the point. The veteran doesn't know. He's not sophisticated, generally, to know that if he picks a VSO, they're going to have greater access to his records and the outcome of the determination by the VA, or at least earlier, than if he goes to a lawyer. Isn't that the simple point you're making?
Yes, Your Honor.
And by the way, this is all constructed by the Secretary.
Absolutely.
There's no statute. There's no custom or usage going back to the Revolution or the Civil War. Sure, there's a lot of history of keeping lawyers out of the process. I understand that. But this particular issue was constructed by the Secretary, a regulation which on its face says VSOs yes, lawyers no.
Absolutely. It's technically.
That sounds like an unconstitutional matter to me. Forget the statute.
Well, I think it is constitutional if it's a fundamentally unfair policy or process. That is true.
Well, isn't it?
Well, I've said it, I believe, and I agree. I think it's the brass tacks is you can't get past Cushman if you allow one group to do something, another group to do the other, and that is fundamentally unfair. And I will just conclude by saying that.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose the, as I understand the regulation, the VA says if you pick a VSO, they get this access. If you pick a lawyer, they don't. What if they pick their mother or their sister or
do they
have any status?
The way the M21 reads, it's VSOs only.
VSOs only?
Everybody else is out, including.
How did this come about? Do you know? How old is this?
Is this
lobbying by the VSOs? Got the ear of a particular secretary?
I defer to the secretary, but I believe the arguments lasted go back decades. It's tradition. I mean, I don't know where it's. I believe my understanding is that the roots of it is lawyers were bad after the Civil War.
Isn't there a Supreme Court case? Isn't it Brown against Gardner? That says just because they're sitting over there in splendid isolation for years doesn't make it right. Is that the argument you're making here? Just because they've been doing it all these years?
Your Honor, I believe that this is, other than a violation, it's really an abuse of discretion of the 5701 the Secretary may. Right? So it is discretionary. Don't argue it's discretionary. I fear they're going to yank the whole thing. No one's going to get to see these draft completed because it's a good thing. They wouldn't have done it this way if it wasn't a good thing. What I'm asking for is more good thing, not less. And could the Secretary say, yes, we're going to pull it because we don't want lawyers in? Yes. But what does that tell you? And that's really what we're getting at here is there's some underlying, I think we've seen a little bit of its surface, but there's some underlying reason that's not coming out why lawyers have been put out here. We want to be partners in its quest to ensure accuracy in decisions as well as VSOs, and I think 30 years Congress has been convinced at least 3 times to move us farther into the position. Into the system because of that. Are there bad apples? Certainly. Report the bad apples.
So, Mr. Rosinski, can we talk a little bit about the remedy that you seek here?
Yes,
what would you have this court do?
I would have the court strike the current regulation, policy, whatever they call it now. It's an M21, and order that any access granted to any information or documents or evidence held by the Secretary be uniformly applied to all represented veterans, claimants, appellants.
Okay, that gets to the merits of your petition. But how do we get to the merits? Assuming that we have, you have standing for a moment, we don't have a, or maybe we do, a final decision before us from the Secretary, do we?
Well, that's why we're on petition, Your Honor.
Well, we do.
They said no, and we'll let you know if we change our mind.
They said no in an email, right?
From the official representative of the Office of General Counsel.
So
that is their position.
I suppose that could be construed as a decision.
Alternatively,
did you receive any appellate rights notice?
No, that's why I'm petitioning.
Right. So how do we get past the hurdle of arguably not having a final decision from the Secretary and you not being provided an appellate rights notice?
Well, I think you can order them to make that decision, mm-hmm. and then we can take it up yet again. But I believe that you could also just ask them today, what's the Secretary's position?
Mm-hmm.
The last time we were here, I believe they said it was tradition and said, we're going to do it. And they continued to do it.
Very good. I think your time has
yes,
expired 5 minutes ago. I had additional. Yeah, you have another question?
Yeah, I would have some questions
you
if
have
you
more
don't
questions?
Mind.
Yeah. No.
Add 5 more minutes, please.
So you would want this court, in answer to the Chief's question, the court to tell the Secretary to revamp his policy with respect to who gets what, and it should be applied equally to everybody?
Well, I believe that the most straightforward method, if I may suggest it, is that this unequal access policy violates Cushman's constitutional right to fundamentally fair process for those who are excluded.
And the other possible remedy would be to the court to say to the Secretary, act on that request?
With some trepidation of Judge Greenberg's reaction, yes, you could take that half step. But I also believe that you could ask them right now. They know this was coming. It's the second time they've been here. The Secretary doesn't give you an answer. It'll be the ninth time we haven't got an answer. At some point, you just got to take a no.
Can I? Do I have time for
one more
question?
Absolutely.
You mentioned something about veterans or claimants would take 5 years more to get to the end of this process. What does that mean?
The only alternative to fixing something before it's promulgated, all right, is what we're doing. We try to fix things that are, overlook the record. Hey, we'll do that. We'll redo the decision. If not, that's got to go to the board. And that's what they have told me on every time I've inquired. And in the first petition, I gave an example of a case where they had transposed years in a date and said the guy wasn't where he was, and he was, they wouldn't change it. And that's what, because once it's promulgated, their position is technically correct. Once it's promulgated, we can't change anything. That's why it's so valuable to get in between the notice letter and the rating decision and fix things like that, because we're all working together, whether they believe it or not, to not appeal as much stuff. And that's why it takes 5 years, because that's how long it takes to go to the board now.
So one of the reasons supposedly the Secretary has for this policy is to fix errors like factual errors, like maybe somebody's date of something, birthday or something, not to redo the decision. And so you're saying that to fix that factual error would take 5 years?
Once it's an appeal, the board doesn't get to it for 5 years. They might take 30 seconds
but
to go, you're right.
But it would go on appeal. It could go on appeal without with the VSO.
Well, it could. They could say we don't agree with you. But also, I think the review is broader. It's broader in practice. It's also broader in the language, which, again, they're more familiar with the language. But it's just to point out issues. I believe in the VA. People want to do the right thing. If I pointed out, for example, I get a herbicide case from Thailand that they said it's been established that no herbicides were used in Thailand. They send that everyone from the Columbia Regional Office. That's the rating decision. I make a living on that sentence. If I could point out that that sentence was overcome by a May 2010 issuance of the Secretary who rescinded that and maybe get them to take it out of their computers, but in that guy's case, I could probably, if they really want to do the right thing, they would go, oh, I didn't know that, or, okay, yeah, I'll take that out, you're right, and then let them do whatever. I'm not telling them what to do. I'm just saying that's wrong. Here's the cases. Here's the policies. A lot of these people don't get these things. They really don't, and they're using letters from 6 and 10 years ago. And I really believe they don't know it. I don't think they sit there and say, this is how I'm going to deny somebody. But when they do deny somebody and the law has changed, even if it changed last week, I can add that, as can some VSOs. But those are the things we're looking at. That's what I'm concerned with. Dates, yes. It's ridiculous to spend 5 years on a dying man to go to the board. We got it done in a year and a half because he was dying. But it's ridiculous. They want it's part of the hamster wheel we're trying to work together to take out. And they're taking it out, and they're eliminating one of the most valuable resources to do that by saying we don't play well.
Thank you, Mr. Rosinski.
Thank you, Mr. Rosinski. Ms. Fasina, I added 20 minutes to appellant's time. If you need it, you may have 20 additional minutes as well.
Thank you, Chief Judge. May it please the Court, Your Honors. The Court should dismiss Mr. Rosinski's writ petition for the following two reasons. First, his arguments of personal standing, just like the arguments that he made in his last writ petition that this Court dismissed, are hypothetical and speculative and not sufficient to demonstrate that he suffers or will imminently suffer an injury in fact. Second, he fails to meet the two criteria that are necessary to establish third-party standing. Therefore, because Mr. Rosinski bears the burden of establishing standing and fails to do so, the Secretary would respectfully request that this Court again dismiss this petition. So if I may first address personal standing very quickly, the Court addressed this in the last petition, and Mr. Rosinski has not asserted any new facts that would change his personal standing. As this Court found, it does not prevent lack of access to draft rating decisions does not prevent Mr. Rosinski from representing his clients. And here I would like to make a couple corrections. There is an assertion of there being a five-year delay, that going through the appellate process being the only way that one can correct these sort of clerical errors, and that's simply not true. As the Court recognized in the last petition, there is a manual provision that provides for correction even after promulgation of these typical errors that might be found in a narrative or code sheet, such as incorrect coding, such as getting the service dates wrong, etc. So this is not the process really isn't necessarily different. He is not necessarily having to go through the entire appellate process, the NOD process, in order to get these errors corrected.
What about his assertion that the Thailand example that he gave in the herbicide letters, is that one of those things that would fall into what you're talking about?
So, Your Honor, under the manual, it typically contemplates, and this is both for draft review decisions, so prior to promulgation and after promulgation, it really contemplates these clear error corrections. It's not contemplating substantive corrections or disagreements with the decision, and the manual actually makes that clear too, that even VSOs who can look at the draft decisions, if they have a disagreement with the decision, they can't correct that through the draft decision process. They still have to appeal that. So really, there's no significant
difference. Well, how do you know that? Have you ever seen one of these transactions? Where the VSO representative physically in the building, physically at the table, where the RO person, examiner, whatever they are, official of the VA, puts the decision out, reads through it, they presumably have an exchange, and a correction is made, change is made or not made. How do you know whether it's substantive or not?
So
how does the secretary know that?
So a couple answers to your question, Your Honor. The first is, no, I have not personally been at a table where that process has been undergone, but the manual specifically states, and Your Honor, I know that you had mentioned that it was a regulation, but it's not in a statute or regulation. It's only contained in a manual as an internal policy. the manual specifically states that actual disagreements with the decision itself have to be appealed through the appeals process. And we have statistics that really show then that the draft review decision process is not what affects the ultimate level of decisions that get corrected. Specifically, the most recent statistics show that 10.64 of attorney-represented cases are sent back for correction before promulgation, 9.62 of VSO-represented cases, and 8.73% of pro se cases are sent back for correction before promulgation. And what these numbers show, Your Honors, is that the internal quality review process that the Veterans Benefits Administration instituted in 2012 is catching these errors. That it's not the draft review decision process that is somehow giving some significant benefit or resulting in disparity between attorneys and VSOs. And in fact, here it actually shows that more attorney-represented cases are sent back for correction.
Well, let me ask you a question. I have two questions, actually. The first one is, what's the Secretary's reasoning behind limiting access to only VSOs? What's the actual basis for that?
So, Your Honors, there are multiple facets to answer that question. The first, certainly there is this historical special relationship between VSOs and VA, in that VSOs certainly originally, before VA instituted this quality review process, they kind of served as a next level of quality higher review.
Okay, we have history. What else?
We have history. We also have that there is a difference between attorneys and VSOs, and this is something that Congress has established. So
where?
In various statutes. For example, VSOs can have internal offices within VA under, I believe it's 5701D. VSOs can have access to internal VA documents. And VSOs also, many of them are congressionally chartered organizations that have reporting requirements to Congress or to VA, and that attorneys do not have. So certainly there are
differences. Okay, are there any others?
And perhaps a big difference, Your Honor, is that VSOs certainly are not allowed to charge for representation, while attorneys are. So we find these two groups to not be similarly situated.
All right, my second, is there anything else? We've got three. I understand them.
Correct. And back to the historical reasons, certainly we're interested in keeping this an informal, non-adversarial process. And we had gone into more detail in this in some of our prior responses to the last petition, but certainly the two groups have different, you know, ethical requirements and different obligations to their clients, model rules of professional conduct, et cetera. So our premise is that these two groups are not similarly situated, and that is a premise that Congress has established and has continued to treat these two groups differently.
Well, let me answer the second question I have for you. What if a VSO, I mean, I'm looking behind you, I see a couple of very distinguished lawyers representing veterans. What if the VSO hired the lawyer, and the lawyer, on behalf of the VSO, wanted to take a look? What would be the Secretary's position?
Your Honor, I'm not certain that I'm aware of a circumstance where the VSO hires the attorney, you're saying on behalf of the client.
Yes.
And then has the attorney take a look.
I think that's the wave of the future, frankly. I think you're going to see a lot more of that. Smart VSOs hire smart law firms to represent their members and brag about it. You get these top lawyers when you join this VSO as opposed to that one.
Your Honor,
happens all the time in the private sector, and it has for decades.
Sure, and we might see that also before the court,
so
but not
what,
in this
So what's the Secretary's
process?
Position on that? I, Lawyer A, am here representing Veteran B, but I'm being paid by VSO C. Do I get access the same as the VSO? Under the current scheme of the Secretary.
Under the current scheme, Your Honors, no. If the attorney is the representative, they would not have access. It's only VSOs that we give access to. And, Your Honors, if I may return to the standing issue, because for us that's the primary issue.
I think you should answer Judge Greenberg's questions, counsel.
I think she has. I'm satisfied.
I have a follow-on question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So the VSO can get access, the attorney, but can the claimant themselves get access?
To the draft decision?
Yes.
No, Your Honor.
And what would be the reason for that?
So, Your Honor, we have logistical and legal concerns with that. Logistically, certainly access would involve access to certain systems that presently not all pro se veterans might have access to. And legally, as we discussed in the prior petition, we have concerns under the court's decision in Sellers, where if a claimant is provided a decision that looks like a final decision, even if it's not intended to be so, it's transmuted into this final appealable binding decision. And between those logistical and legal concerns, that is our concern with expanding this access to attorneys, in that we would be hard justified to not then expand it to pro se veterans, and that would raise those concerns for the Secretary.
And another just a little question that goes kind of what Judge Greenberg was saying. What if the VSO just happened to be an attorney?
The VSO representative.
Yeah, the VSO
sure.
representative.
That does not make a difference necessarily to us. The VSO, if they are as part of a veteran service organization, they have been granted access, internal access through VA's internal policy as set forth in the manual.
Let me ask you this. Is there a list of approved VSOs that the Secretary maintains who have access? What if I came in and I said, I, Greenberg, am a VSO? Do I get access?
Yes, Your Honor. VA does keep a list of VSOs that are recognized by
How many are on that list?
I apologize, Your Honor, I'm not aware of that.
How did they come to be placed on that list? What's the process by which the Secretary approves the VSOs to be put on the list?
I believe, Your Honor, that's contained in 5902, which is recognition of representatives of organizations. It has specific directions for the Secretary as set forth by Congress as to how to recognize veteran service organizations.
I'm asking for purposes of access to these draft reports, or is it the same?
It's the same, Your Honor.
So any organization that's recognized by the Secretary pursuant to this statute has access?
That's my understanding.
And no others?
That's also my understanding, Your Honor.
And you don't think that it was necessary to go for the Secretary to do this by way of the Administrative Procedure Act and promulgate a regulation, rather than just bury it in the M21 that the world doesn't get to see?
So, respectfully, Your Honor, our position is that notice and comment rulemaking was not required. This is an internal policy. It is not, there's no statute or regulation that requires VA to allow anybody to see a decision before promulgation. The laws and regulations affecting final decisions insofar as notice or appeal rights, those are not being affected here. And so the Secretary's position is that notice and comment rulemaking was not required. This is an internal policy.
Well, what about this? Sorry.
Go ahead.
What about this 38 CFR 1.577A? Isn't that a regulation that provides the veteran access to his record and to any information upon request pertaining to him?
Yes, Your Honor. We are aware of that regulation. However, our position is that that regulation needs to be read in context to understand the purpose of that regulation. And
what was the purpose?
So the regulation is promulgated under this whole section about safeguarding veterans' records. And if we look at the Federal Register history, it's not only to provide veterans certainly with access to their official records and to allow them to make copies, to allow VA to charge fees in certain instances for copies, but also to protect the privacy of the veteran. And there's nothing to suggest in the regulation or in the regulatory history that this is meant to be applied to non-final, non-appealable draft decisions.
So in the VA's mind, the term record does not include a draft decision, such as we're talking about.
Correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, if I may, to return to the standing issue, Mr. Rosinski is primarily then here now arguing that he has third-party standing because the majority of the injuries that he alleges, such as delays, are to his clients, not to him. And we would note first, actually, that just like in the prior petition, Mr. Rosinski has not been able to identify any particular client or have any client join his suit. So with third-party standing, the Supreme Court makes it very clear through their case law that generally there's a rule that the individual who is harmed should be the one that brings the claim or asserts the right. However, there are two criteria that could be met to establish third-party standing. The first, that there has to be a close relationship between the person asserting third-party standing and the possessor of the right itself.
Do you dispute that here, a lawyer and a client?
To a certain extent, Your Honor. So we do recognize, as this Court has in the past, and as the Supreme Court has certainly recognized in the past, that there is a special relationship between attorneys and clients. However, as even the Supreme Court noted in Kowalski, and as this Court noted in the case of In re Stanley, that satisfaction of the factor can be weak when the petitioner cannot, when the person bringing the suit, the attorney, cannot show that there's actually been a particular veteran that's been, a particular client, excuse me, so in this case a veteran, that has been adversely affected. So in Kowalski, the Supreme Court found there was no third-party standing because it was all hypothetical clients. And in Reece Stanley, the Court found that even if this first factor was satisfied, the satisfaction was weak because the veteran, or the, excuse me, the attorney could not show that any particular veteran had been adversely affected, could not show that the veteran had been impaired in the ability to hire attorneys or the attorney's willingness to represent clients, etc. So really our position is that we don't believe that that first factor is met, and even if it is, Your Honor, it's weak satisfaction.
All right, and the second?
And the second factor, Your Honor, that must be met is that there has to be a hindrance to the possessor's ability to protect his or her own interests such that we should find third-party standing. And our position is that factor is not met at all. The court in Reece Stanley very clearly set forth that VA claimants are in a bit of a unique situation in that there's no obstacle or hindrance that prevents them from challenging policies if they believe that they have been harmed. And again, we don't have any veteran here who's come forth challenging this policy or joining petitioner in his challenge to this policy. And any allegation that there's been a hindrance to the adjudicatory process, we would dispute that because not only can veterans correct certainly decisions even after promulgation without having to go through the notice of disagreement process, they can certainly go through the notice of disagreement process, they have appeal rights, etc.
Counsel, I wanted to ask you this question earlier, but it really addresses the point where you are, and you mentioned a while back that the M21 has a provision for error correction that counsel could use as well. Did I misunderstand?
No, Your Honor, I did not, yeah.
Could you refer me to what specifically that provision is?
I would be happy to. And I believe the court noted this also in your prior decision. So the exact provision is the M21-1, big Roman numeral 3, small Roman numeral 4, 7B3A. And that entire section A, B, and C.
What does that say?
So it says that the narrative section of the rating decision can be corrected even after promulgation if it's discovered that inaccurate information was provided, for example, such as service date or entitlements. And this provides for the ability for these corrections to be made by sometimes just the decision maker or sometimes the supervisor who will assign to a decision maker to promulgate a new decision if corrections are necessary. There's no new evidence that needs to be submitted. It's just a correction of these
types of errors. Sounds like it's internal with the bureaucrats, the clerks over at the VA. It doesn't say anything about lawyers there. How is a lawyer supposed to know? until he gets the final
There's
version.
There's no preclusion from who identifies the error here. It's just that if an error, an incorrect information is identified even after promulgation, that includes these sort of clear clerical errors, such as getting the service date wrong or some sort of anatomical classification that's wrong, such as saying left instead of right, that right. those can be corrected without having to go through this notice of disagreement appellate
process.
Let
me ask the dumb question. If the lawyer can't see the draft wedding decision, how do they identify errors?
So, Your Honor, this is contemplating even after promulgation. So certainly after promulgation.
As a final wedding decision.
Correct.
Okay.
Even after promulgation and after notice has been given to the claimant, there is this opportunity to correct these sort of errors in either the narrative or the code sheet. Even with the draft decision or this post-promulgation correction process, we're still not talking about correcting what they classify generally as errors that would go through the appellate process, right? So disagreements with the decision itself. We're still talking about errors such as
service
dates.
And how is that done, whether it's by the lawyer, the veteran, or the VSO? How is that brought to the attention of the secretary?
My understanding from a discussion with our client, Your Honor, is that simply it's just brought to the attention that that the VSO or the attorney would reach out to VBA and indicate that they believe that.
Well, no. Who gets the copy of the draft? We're about to promulgate this.
Sure.
Or we've already promulgated it. Here it is. Now, do you have anything to say that would point out an error? Is that what the secretary does?
So,
He sends a notice to the veteran or the VSO?
With the...
Or the lawyer, saying, if you've got a problem with this, let us know now?
So, Your Honor, with the VSO, if we're talking about the draft decision, yes, there is notice provided that there's a 48-hour window that's opened up for them to review. With promulgated decisions, we're talking about decisions where the claimant has been notified of this decision. So certainly if they have a representative, their representative would be simultaneously notified as well.
With the same 48 hours to make the correction?
No, there is no limit on the post-promulgation correction process. The 48-hour is just for the draft.
My struggle here is to understand how this process works, quite apart from why it is supposed to work this way. As I understand it, a document, proposed determination, is physically put on a table in a regional office by the secretary's representative, and a VSO is invited to come and take a look at it and to make whatever comments, presumably these merely technical comments. How is that process to be replicated either by the veteran or the lawyer who isn't in the room, who doesn't know that this is all happening?
So, Your Honor, we're not talking about replicating that specific process. So we're talking about two different stages. One is pre-promulgation, where the VSOs have the 48-hour access, and one is post-promulgation, when the claimant has been provided notification, appeals rights, etc., and their representative, which could be an attorney, is also provided that decision. So I apologize if I'm not fully understanding your question, but the attorney would not be invited into VA's offices after promulgation to review a final appeal decision.
With all due respect, counsel, I must say, I understand your arguments. I think you've got guts to come here and make these arguments on behalf of the secretary, but I'm still at a loss to understand why it is that there is a carve-out other than this, we've always done it this way, for the VSOs as opposed to the veteran or the veteran's lawyer or anyone else who asserts that they are the representative of the veteran. What's the big deal?
And certainly, Your Honor, we absolutely understand this court's concerns, which were also expressed in your prior decision. And to that, I have a few answers, if I may.
Sure.
The first certainly being what we've already discussed that certainly the two groups are not similarly situated, that we would have logistical and legal concerns about expanding this further, but more so that certainly at this point, Your Honors, the Undersecretary is aware of this court's concerns, and I have been told that he is contemplating making a change and planning on making a change to the policy. As to exactly when or how that change is going to look, I cannot say at this time, but this is something that's on his radar and that we are aware of the court's concerns. But I would also then turn the court's attention back to the statistics that we talked about earlier, which show that VA's quality review team is the ones that's correct, are the ones that are correcting the decisions prior to promulgation, that there's no appreciable statistical difference between whether it's attorney represented or VSO represented, and therefore whether or not access to these draft decisions for the 48 hours really impacts the ultimate percentage of cases that are corrected prior to promulgation.
Well, we've got to take your word for it, which we do. You're an officer of the court. You wouldn't lie to us, but you just got this information from your client. People who have a self-interest in justifying this regulation, or this, pardon me, this custom.
Respectfully, Your Honor, our client does keep track of what percentage.
Why? To justify the difference?
No, Your Honor, they've always kept track of this, and certainly prior to that it was kept, statistics were kept track to see whether or not VA's internal quality review was effective, which we can see since 2012 it has been effective in catching these errors before promulgation.
Well, let me ask you this. If it's on this Undersecretary's radar, what's he waiting for? And by the way, in answer to that question, how long does it take to open the door at the RO to allow the VSO to come in and sit at the table and slam the door in the face of a lawyer or a veteran? How much difference is there between opening the door to the VSO or opening the door to the veteran or opening the door to the lawyer? Are you worried about swarms of veterans coming to regional offices to look at their proposed decisions, but unconcerned about swarms of VSOs?
So, Your Honor, as for first, just to address your last point, our statistics show that actually only 36.9% of decisions that are made available to VSOs for review actually undergo this draft review process. So as for swarms of VSOs, Your Honors, the numbers don't show that. But insofar as your question as to why a change has not yet been made, this court issued its decision in the last Rozinski petition at the end of January. And as this court may be aware, VA has certainly undergone some leadership changes since then. Our undersecretary was just confirmed.
Yeah, but the statisticians compiling all these records hasn't changed.
Correct, Your Honor, but the individual that has the authority to make this internal policy change would be the undersecretary, who is not confirmed until the end of April. And as this court might also, I'm sure, is also aware, in the interim, what's been of high priority for the agency has been ensuring that the Appeals Modernization Act is promulgated. And that was recently, the proposed rule was published in August 10th of this year, certainly. And again, I would emphasize that the Undersecretary is certainly aware of this court's concerns surrounding this policy, but given a lot of the changes that are coming anyways to the appeals process, there's time that it takes to contemplate what change to make, how it would look, and to, of course, with the eye of making it consistent with the other major changes that are coming in February 2019 to the entire appellate process.
So speaking of changes, let me read this particular, I have a public reading of this portion of the manual, which is Part 3, Subpart 5, Chapter 2, Big Section, Big B. Draft rating decisions and decision notices are not intended to be final and binding on the VA and must not be shared or transmitted by the VSOs. Now, the change last year, it read that the draft rating decisions and decision notices are not intended to be final and binding and should not be shared or transmitted. So it became from should not be to must not be. And that change took place like near overnight. And so first of all, what was the purpose of that change?
I apologize, Your Honor, I don't have that specific section in front of me, but just I would imagine that certainly that section, the change to must, contemplates some of the concerns that we talked about earlier in terms of this being this informal, non-adversarial process to correct these clear narrative errors, such as service dates being incorrect, and also addressing our concerns that if veterans, if the claimants had notice of this decision, that we would have sellers' concerns that it would transmute it into this final appealable decision. So that seems to, that change seems to be to contemplate to protect that legal problem and prevent that legal problem.
Yeah, could you add 20 minutes? Ms. Fasina, you mentioned the post-promulgation process for correcting errors, and as I read the M21 and everything here, we're really talking about technical errors, not major substantive errors. I assume that there could be technical errors that become major substantive errors, but as I understand the intent of this provision, it really is to correct inaccuracies, maybe in, I don't know, addresses, dates, things like that. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my understanding, too, and even the manual specifically states in the section that provides VSOs this 48-hour review that if they're disagreeing with the decision, that has to go through the appellate process. That's not something that's addressed in the draft review process.
Right. So under the section that deals with post-promulgation of the M21, it says the rating activity must also correct the narrative section of a rating decision if after the claimant has been notified of the decision, it is discovered that, and it goes on the list some of the inaccurate inaccuracies. Do you know how that process works?
The very specific minutia, Your Honor, I don't know, but my understanding is that simply the error, and it can be either the claimant or the representative would bring it to the attention of VBA, that a narrative error had been made and that then VBA would review and pursuant to the manual, I believe it says that the if it's post-promulgation, that a supervisor needs to take a look and then assign it to a decision maker to make the correction if necessary.
Or how long it might take to make the correction?
Respectfully, Your Honor,
to the pre-promulgated drafts?
Sure. So with the pre-promulgated drafts, as we discussed, there's certainly that 48-hour limit, time limit.
For reviewing, yes.
Right. I don't believe there is any time limit for post-promulgation correction of these narrative or code sheet errors. I'm not aware, Your Honor, specifically of exactly how long that takes, but certainly it would be significantly less than going through the appellate process and certainly not the 5 years that petitioner has cited.
Okay. Judge Peach just made an interesting point regarding the change in the M21 language from should not to must not. Do you have current information on that change? Are you operating with the most up-to-date M21 that says must not rather than should not?
We are operating with that. The manual is live. I just apologize. I don't have a printout of that specific section in front of me.
Do you know when that change occurred?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't know when that change occurred, but again, it's always been VA's policy and understanding that it would that this is an informal, non-adversarial 48-hour review, that it's not meant to be shared with claimants, and I think that manual makes it consistent with the must.
Well, I'm just trying to get to how easy it may, it appears, perhaps, that the M21 could be changed. If this obviously happened certainly since January of 2018, because the should not language was there in January of 2018, but it's not there anymore, as far as I can tell. So there's a change that happened pretty quickly at the VA. And that's all we're talking about here is the M21, not a statute, not a regulation.
Right.
So part of my frustration in this case is, as I indicated in my concurrence, and I know you've read it, but at the conclusion of that concurrence, I asked the department to consider whether justifications behind this policy were consistent with current realities of the attorney's involvement in these cases. And you actually gave me at least some information that I feel a little bit better about. That is that the undersecretary seems to be aware of our concern and is doing, well, may be doing something about it. But I guess the problem I have is that it's just not fast enough under these circumstances. Who is your supervisor?
My deputy chief counsel?
Yes.
Or she's not available today.
No, I asked the question.
Nicole
who
Cottle.
Is she?
Nicole Cottle.
And who is her boss?
David Quinn and Mary Flynn.
Okay.
Yep.
Mary Flynn, could you approach the bench, please? Good afternoon, Ms. Flynn. I guess it's morning still. It seems like it's afternoon. It's been a long time here. Thank you for being in attendance. I recognize that you're usually here anyway. So I need to know if you have any additional information than what Ms. Lucina has provided us regarding policy changes or the process that is being considered to make adjustments, perhaps, to this policy. Can you shed any light on this? And I really, I mean, my question to you in addition to that is, what have you all been doing since January of 2018 after this first opinion came out?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing me to address that.
Thank you.
After your decision came out in the first Rozinski case, as is our practice, I provided a copy to our stakeholders. So I provided a copy to the Undersecretary for Benefits, the BVA, and I also provided a copy to our General Counsel and my immediate supervisor, Dick Hipplett. We raised the concerns, as we had prior to the argument, that we thought that perhaps this was a policy that had become outdated due to the changes in the way that claims are being adjudicated now. As Judge Greenberg mentioned, this policy sort of came out of the days when people were huddled around a table and sharing paper. That's not our world anymore. It's almost 100% electronic. There aren't tables in ROs anymore. It's all being done in VBMS. And so the draft review notice comes in an alert to VBMS. But we talked about the problems that this policy from the optics of it, it looked like there were disparities, although there may be valid reasons for treating the groups differently. And we asked them to reconsider and see if this was a place where a change could be made. As you might expect, this is a political issue. And so there are many, many people that are having a voice in it. But after the decision came out, we said, not a big surprise. This policy is still a point of concern. And we were assured that it was being looked at. When the new Undersecretary, Dr. Lawrence, was sworn in, Mr. Hipplett, Dave Behrens, myself, met with Dr. Lawrence and the principal deputy principal, Margarita Devlin. I believe she is the chief of staff. And this was among several topics that we raised as issues of concern that, as general counsel, we had with VBA, and we asked that they please take a hard look at it, and we were told they would. We had a follow-up meeting after, because at that point we were aware that this case was likely going to be scheduled for an argument. We also had a follow-up meeting about 3 weeks ago to say we are going before the court. Is there anything that we can tell the judges about what is being done about the policy? And we were told, as Ms. Fusina said, it is being considered. They have several options that are being looked at. They hope to make a decision soon, but they were not willing to share it with us at that time. So I tell you, it has definitely been on our radar, both in OGC and more importantly in front of the USP. I feel that we have done all that we can to advocate that a decision be made, but it's in the decision maker's hands at this point, and I'm sorry I'm not able to tell you what he's going to do.
And that's at the VBA, if I understand you, with the undersecretary.
Yes.
And Dr. Lawrence, as I understand it, was also confirmed in April. Is that right? Okay.
Okay. Sure. I'd just like to commend both counsel for the VA for your candor and your knowledge.
Thank you, Your
I've
Honor.
Been pretty hard on the VA on this particular issue, but I have no problem in complimenting you and your colleague for the presentations that you've made to the court today, and thank you for it.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. Flynn, I appreciate the information you shared with us. I know I probably caught you a little off guard, but I'd like to get to the bottom of some of this and see some changes made. But thank you very much for the information you just shared with us.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Fasina, you may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. And the one other thing that we would like to emphasize, as I believe, Your Honor, you also recognized in your concurring opinion, which is to note the court's concerns with this policy, but not necessarily to direct VA whether to provide access for all or to not provide access for all and exactly what that would look like. So we would respectfully request, certainly we're standing by our standing issues, that the petitioner here has not demonstrated either personal or third-party standing and that the petition should be dismissed, but also to respectfully request that the court permit the undersecretary the time to make changes to this policy and not dictate exactly what those changes would look like.
Yeah, well, that's certainly something we'll take under advisement. I'm troubled by how quickly two words can change in the M21, but I understand the complexities of policy changes and all that. Let me ask you something about remedies. What do you think is the appropriate remedy here?
So
I can probably answer that question, but go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. What we are requesting is that the court again dismiss this petition for lack of standing. That certainly we're well aware of the court's concerns regarding this policy, but separate from that, the court has adopted the case or controversy requirement, which requires standing, and since there has been no showing of personal or third-party standing, that the appropriate legal remedy would be to dismiss this petition. And if I may make just a few other points, just because we did not have additional briefing on this case, and petitioner here raised these points in his argument. The first, Judge Greenberg, I believe you said you would ask me this question, but I'm not sure you've gotten a chance to, which is that whether these decisions are being published, and our answer to that would be that this court has long viewed that published decisions have been adequate to inform the public of this court's precedential decisions on various matters. Certainly, any decision, just like the prior decision this court rendered on the petition, would be published on the court's website, on legal research portals such as Lexis and Westlaw, that the public has access to this and the bar does at large as well, so that this has always been considered sufficient notice of the court's position and decisions.
Well, if I may, do you know the matter of Staub versus Shulkin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Has Staub been paid?
Yes, Your Honor.
When?
Yes. Mr. Staub has been paid for many of his claims in accordance with an interim final rule that VA promulgated in January of this year that adopted the court's ruling in Staub. Since then, he does have some other outstanding claims, but he has submitted additional evidence and information that VA has to consider.
So that's undergoing the adjudicatory process, and he will be issued a decision on those specific claims. But he has, Your Honor, been paid on many of his claims.
Yeah, but why did it take a rule promulgation to pay Staub? We issued an order. We rejected two, maybe three applications from the VA to stay it.
Yes, Your Honor. Respectfully, the decisions made were to promulgate the interim final rule that adopted the court's changes to the interpretation of the statute, which VA had previously held, and to have those that officially go through notice and comment to go through the public notice process, which is why it was published as an interim final rule, so that that would be in place so that Mr. Staub could get paid, which was done in January of this year, Your Honor.
And when was that decision of the court? 2 years before that, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But Mr. Staub has been paid for many of his claims in accordance with the court's ruling in that case.
Got it.
All right. Could I go back to where your third-party standing argument is, and the idea that in order to get third-party standing, you would need among one of two things, or a close relationship. So if I could kind of go through the elements of a close relationship so that I can understand your argument.
Sure, Your Honor. And just to clarify, it's both criteria.
Yes,
actually.
But I want to go just to the close relationship. Yes. Uh-huh. A close relationship exists when the third party, and that would be the client in this case, mm-hmm. and the would-be plaintiff, which would be Mr. Rosinski in this case, are related such that the challenged conduct, which in this case is the denial of the draft RO decision, as enforced against the would-be plaintiff, Mr. Rosinski, serves to impair rights held by the third party, the client. So the question I have is, what is that right? What do you see as that right of the client?
Well, so, Your Honor, we would, as we've consistently stated, there is no statutory or regulatory mandate that any party, whether it's a VSO or an attorney or the pro se veteran, have access to review non-final, non-appealable, non-binding draft decisions. So, Your Honor, we would certainly posit that petitioner has not demonstrated that specific right to demonstrate the close relationship, and certainly he has not been able to identify any particular veteran that's been adversely affected by not having access to a draft decision. And insofar as, and this does go towards the second aspect of third-party standing, that there has to actually be a hindrance shown. And if there truly is a hindrance to any veteran's interests or rights, they are not harmed by this court dismissing petitioner's petition because they're not denied a forum to assert their own constitutional rights. They have the ability. There are no obstacles or hindrance that prevents them from asserting any rights if they believe they have been so harmed. But any rights insofar as adjudication, we certainly don't find that there has been any hindrance in the normal adjudicatory process, the process of notice of disagreement, appeal rights, or even getting decisions corrected post-promulgation. So
even though the client doesn't have the entitlement to the draft decision, same as but the VSO does?
Correct, Your Honor.
Ms. Fusina, could the letter to Mr. Rosinski be viewed as a final determination from the agency?
Your Honor, our position is that it's not a final appealable decision.
So if the court were to direct you to issue one, you could do that?
Yes, Your Honor. So to that question, the court would first need to find that Mr. Rosinski does have standing. And if that's the case, then the court would also need to find that he's entitled, then the court could potentially choose to go the avenue that it did in the Chisholm case, Your Honor, which certainly we would again emphasize, like in the Chisholm case, the court did not go so far as to direct the secretary to either grant or deny access, but just to issue an appealable decision that could be appealed to the board. So, but that's, again, in this case, that's only if the court finds that Mr. Rosinski has standing, either through personal standing or third-party standing, and we would strongly emphasize our point that just like in the first decision, he does not have personal standing, and he also has not demonstrated third-party standing.
What was the end of the Chisholm story? Do you know?
My understanding is that I believe a decision might have been promulgated. I apologize. I don't know the specifics of what has happened in that case
since. Well, the court ordered the secretary to,
yes, to
issue a decision.
Correct.
Was a decision issued?
My understanding is that one was. I'm not entirely certain, Your Honor. I apologize.
Don't guess.
You don't know, you don't know.
You don't know, you don't
know. I apologize. I'm not aware of whether a decision was issued, but.
You know anything else about the post-Chisholm after it left this court?
As for whether or not paralegals were granted access?
Have paralegals been given access or not? You know?
I also apologize, Your Honor. I am not aware of the specifics of that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Fassini.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, I have a number of rebuttal points, but I will begin with responding to the Chief Judge's question. Section 5701. B1, in read in conjunction with Section A, all files, records, reports, and other papers and documents pertaining to any claim under the laws administered by the Secretary, B1, shall make disclosure of such files, records, reports, and other papers and documents as described above as follows. B1, to a claimant or duly authorized agent or representative of a claimant as to matter concerning the claimant alone when, in the judgment of the Secretary, such disclosure would not be injurious to the physical or mental health of the claimant and to any independent medical experts, etc. They cite 5701D, which is as a matter of discretion, the Secretary may authorize an inspection of department records by duly authorized representatives of a recognized organization, which I believe both float down to it's a duty of the Secretary to release it to the veteran or representative. It's discretionary to release it to the VSOs, and as I said, we can boil this down to abuse of discretion to only VSOs. The second point is the actual nature of the section under dispute. As in your decision, I'm quoting the M21 procedure manual provides, quote, that the purpose of this review is to, internal quote, identify any clear errors or matters of clarification that require significant discussion and or correction prior to promulgation. This is not correcting the narrative section of a rating decision or changing a number in the rating table. This is the language that we're challenging, this clear error. There was no AO used in Thailand. That's clear error. Yes, there was. Here it is. Again, I don't think any rating officer is going to say, I ain't changing that, go appeal it. That is the purpose of what we're looking for. That is their own language. Further, I want to make sure we're clear on the third-party standing issue. And it is a close relationship, which attorney-client has been found repeatedly by the Supreme Court to satisfy, and an impediment or burden on the individual trying to change, to assert his rights. Here we have two ways of interpreting that. One, they have literally slammed the door in the veteran's representatives, and would be the veteran if he showed, to go and review this document. That is a physical impediment, if not also a legal impediment, as well as they've impeded my ability to perform that function. Right? So the second impediment that I raised in my initial argument was we've been trying to get this fixed. Not only the veteran, but myself have been trying for 4.5 years to get this fixed. The court just went through a very interesting session here about trying to get it fixed within the VA. It isn't fixed. That's the impediment, not that how this right is impeded. It is impeded. The impediment is to try to assert their own rights, to try to get it changed, not that whatever the VA is doing causes some impediment to the rights, but that they're trying to assert their rights to, and they can't. So they need a third party to do it.
Well, what about Ms. Quinn and Ms. Fusina, sorry, did I have that right? Assertion that the secretary is working hard on this.
I have quite a lot of letters. I think every one of my veterans has received at least once, "We are working on your claim." That's nice. I appreciate that. It may go to how long you may reserve your opinion on this, but there's other examples of where it's just time. I mean, what does it take to strike that? Strike VSOs out of that, or do something interim while you study it. The numbers, I don't understand the numbers. The numbers, quality people, that's all magic. The point is, I tried to see Mr. Gall's rating decisions, couldn't.
Well, what about this other point that Ms. Quinn made, that it's all electronic now?
Yes, that's right. What are my points? I'm on VBMS. I'm on the VA mail system. I have a VA mail address.
Wouldn't that buttress your position as to there's no impediment, there's no harm or no efficiency or inefficiency?
A different definition of impediment. No, to me, the easiest thing is you send me an email. You could send me a regular email to my business address that says, "Decision in, completed decision in X is posted. It'll be posted for the next 48 hours. I go to VBMS, I'll look at it. They can put it in a special thing. They can put it in a VA email to me on their on their secure system. I can go, tell me where it is, I'll go look at it. If I have comments, I can send them back to you. I can call you. If you want me to drive over there and look at it on your computer, I can do that. Some attorneys may not be able to, but I can. Give me 48 hours. Give me 21 days. What's the difference in 5 years? I mean, I've got 750.
Well, what do you have to say about counsel for the secretary disputing your 5-year statement?
It doesn't take 5 years to get a change at the RO if we could use this process. I was talking about the appeal. The alternative for my veteran is a 5-year appeal cycle.
But is that true, counsel? Doesn't the M21-1, and didn't Ms. Fusina say that, in fact, you can do corrections post-promulgation?
A, my other petition showed you an example where they said, no, you can't. And B, it's only the narrative section. It is not, as this is, to identify clear errors. What I'm hearing is I couldn't do what I just said. I could not send review the narrative section and say, hey, you forgot X case. Or that statement has been rescinded by the secretary 5 years ago. They're not going to take that on narrative. But this one allows clear error. I get it. We're not going to sit around and say, well, were you at the right base or were you at this? No, but if you say no AO in Thailand the whole time, that's pretty clear. It's yes or no. I'm saying it's yes, you say it's no, let's resolve it. Okay, maybe we could actually force some of these cooperative things because, we're getting these every day. What's wrong with that sentence in these decisions? Because these are repeat errors that we're talking about. And in some cases, there may be not repeat error, but you can prevent a repeat error right there where it happens with the person who's signing the letters. And just the whole thing about numbers and percentages, if this draft review process isn't working, why are we defending it? Why are they defending it? Why are we here taking the court's time if it's if it actually, according to their numbers, the way I understand statistics, they do better to get rid of it. But then we're telling everybody how important it is. And it is important. I don't want to get rid of it. And back to the third party. I'm going to read from Kowalski, Justice Thomas's concurrence. These are the examples that he gives for the Supreme Court outside of attorney-client. We have held, for instance, that beer vendors have standing to raise the rights of their prospective young male customers. that criminal defendants have standing to raise the rights of jurors excluded from service. That's pretty close on that one. That sellers of mail-order contraceptives have standing to assert the rights of potential customers. That distributors of contraceptives to unmarried persons have standing to litigate the rights of potential recipients. And that white sellers of land have standing to litigate the constitutional rights of potential black purchasers. Notice the potential there. This is my client list. Every one of these has one or three or seven rating decisions. All right, I'll be happy to submit it to the court, properly redacted, to prove the case. All of these people have had rating decisions that I could have prevented the second or third or fourth trip. I've got a veteran who's been to the board five times on the same issue because the regional office refuses to accept a single point or put it in the rating decision. Maybe I could have saved one of those, but if this is necessary for evidence, I'd be happy to do it. But I do refer the Kowalski case to the court. It did find that this attorney did not have standing because it was for potential clients. He did not have clients. He was worried about getting future clients. I've got clients, and so does every attorney who appears before you, or they wouldn't be here. So with that, I would make one final comment. We attorneys are seeming to be getting beat over the head because we comply with the model rules. Those model rules say what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to do these things. If we comply with the model rules, however, the VA says we can't come in. We literally can't come in the door because the model rules they enforce on us prevent that. That alone is a troublesome conclusion from what I heard today. And with that, if there are no further questions,
I do. Speeches. If I could. Going back to your third-party standing argument and the close relationship element, can you again tell me what right was impaired, what right of your client was impaired?
I'm glad you asked that. I actually had this on here. The right of the client is the Cushman right to fundamental fairness, right? It's not the right to review or the right to this or the right to that. It's the right to fundamental fairness of the rating procedure. I believe that's an exact quote. They say procedure. Back when they were having secret reviews, okay, the same type of process. Some people got them, some people didn't. You couldn't challenge who did it. The process for rating, review, and correction, and appeal should and is, as I read Cushman, required to be fundamentally fair. And when it is determined by whether the person who represents you has a law degree or not, that is not, I have heard nothing that calls that fair or it supports the fundamental fairness of that process. Now, that's an important point whether they change this or not, because again, they could change it back. All right, I would ask that the court issue something here so that all attorneys can point to that when or if something slips through the cracks again, or there are other procedures like this. The F-21 is changing 24 hours a day, as far as I can tell. And unless we have a precedential decision that we can use, and perhaps we may have to come back for a class on some other, this could occur, it could pop up over here. It's like mushrooms. There's no list of changes every day that I'm aware of or available to me. So unless there's some clear direction on this issue at least, I would ask that the court make it clear that it can't pop up again. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Levinsky. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will come down and greet counsel.